This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from WKSU at Kent State University in Kent, Ohio. Thanks so much for listening. And this, you might say, is the King James version of our program here in the heart of Cleveland Cavaliers country in the home of LeBron James, who led his team to victory in their NBA playoff game against the Chicago Bulls last night. And we have a standing room only live studio audience of public radio fans and voters, I presume. Are you all voters out there?
Yeah!
Excellent. Well, here's a question. Would you like to be liberated from that hose down of campaign commercials that's going to start here in Ohio very, very soon?
Yes!
Okay. Then join us at The Takeaway in calling for the elimination of the Electoral College, which would stop the gaming of the system by all those big donors. It would eliminate swing states. It would eliminate cliffhangers like Florida, Florida, Florida. All that malarkey in 2000, done. There'd be no more Southern strategies. Sure, it would be more boring, but then maybe it would be more democratic. That's our little hope here at The Takeaway. Are you with us?
Yeah.
All right, now, I want to warn everybody that a little later in the program, we will be talking about Adolf Hitler's new hit TV show. It's a vision of a German novelist who has brought back Der Führer in a new book that imagines Hitler in our time. It's a comedy. It's actually a funny fantasy that kind of grows on you. It's also a bestseller in Germany, which may be the most interesting thing about it. But we begin with the old question of where does Ohio sit in the upcoming 2016 campaign, which already has a flotilla of Republican candidates, declared and undeclared, major figures and minor figures, while the Democrats have the enormous SS Hillary Clinton being chased by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Well, here are the official major candidates on the Republican side. There are plenty of minor candidates. Go online. You can find counts of people who've actually filled out the proper paperwork. It goes up to 15 declared candidates. But you know about Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, former HP CEO Carly Fiorina, Dr. Ben Carson, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and you've got the interest, expressed interest candidates. Read, please send your campaign test dollars. That's former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, Ohio Governor John Kasich right here in Ohio, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. There's also former New York Governor George Pataki, former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, and Donald Trump. For a look at the current state of Republicans trying to occupy the White House, we are joined by Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Hi, Todd.
Hi, John.
So there's a huge number of Republican candidates. Actually, I went online. You can count as many as 15 declared candidates going down to the really, really minor ones. But how would we separate the mainstream candidates, if you want to call it that, into tiers at this point?
Yeah, you know, and when you get a field this big, you kind of have to, or else you just get absolutely inundated. You know, I think you can have a top tier of sort of like legitimate presidential contenders, a second tier of legitimate candidates who have a chance to get into the first tier if they run a great campaign or if they catch on a particular issue. And then what you'd probably have to call vanity candidates, maybe people who want to burnish their reputations or get on television or think it'd be fun to run for president, or maybe have a one issue sort of campaign that kind of gets them out on the trail for a couple of months.
All right. So in the first tier, in that front runner tier, certainly Jeb Bush would be in that tier.
Jeb Bush, who hasn't even declared a candidacy yet. He doesn't
right.
even fit into your list of 12 or 15.
Exactly.
Clearly, he's going to be a candidate eventually, and he's raising money hand over fist right now via his super PAC, which is called America Rising Super PAC. So you got Bush for sure. You got Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, the governor in Wisconsin. Rand Paul has to be on the list, and I would say Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee probably at the bottom of the first tier on the border of the top of the second.
And break them down in terms of centrist versus classic primary candidates who are really going to go for that conservative wing. Certainly Scott Walker is the front runner if you're just talking about Tea Party voters.
Yeah, that's right. And then you can look, you know, you can parse Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina all you want and come up with sort of different cocktails of who's the conservative front runner. You know, in terms of Iowa, it's probably Scott Walker also, but you have to put Mike Huckabee way at the top because he came in second in Iowa, beat Mitt Romney in 2012. You can't forget that. For anyone who thinks that Mike Huckabee is just kind of a Fox News personality, politically he is much, much more than that, and he can raise money. Now, Jeb Bush, as we mentioned before, probably the only true centrist in the top tier or someone who can present himself as one, and that goes to prove to you why he's so very unpopular with conservatives, like in the Iowa caucus early polling. We don't have to get in too far into the polling right now. It's just so early. But if you want to take it upon yourself to get on the internet and see where right. Jeb Bush is in Iowa, it's not great. Jeb Bush has already articulated policy positions on things like immigration and education that aren't in line with conservatives and Tea Party voters and activists. So that helps explain it and also helps explain why Jeb Bush might be running kind of a much longer strategy here that goes well past Iowa and New Hampshire and really looks towards a general election when he's running presumably against Hillary Clinton.
Quickly on the front runners again, if Jeb Bush is the only centrist, that would assume you're not counting Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, whose star seems to be fading. What's the buzz on Christie? And then we'll move.
Yeah, because I put him sort of on the borderline of the second tier, and I suppose I could have mentioned Christie in the first. This is all quite subjective. His star has been on the fade. The bridge scandal in New Jersey, and probably more than that, controversies over state pensions in that state have hurt Christie. He's also never been hugely popular among conservatives, and this early in a primary, arch conservatives are the only ones who care about all this stuff, them and donors and journalists. And Christie hasn't been a darling of those conservatives at all, which tells you if he can survive the early primaries and somehow move from my borderline subjective second tier into the first, he's somebody who could be a credible centrist candidate in a general election. The problem is getting there, and that's a huge climb for Christie right now.
If John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, enters the ring, does that annoy Scott Walker or Ted Cruz more, do you think?
Yeah, you know, probably Walker, I would suppose, and he probably wants to annoy Walker a lot more because Walker's a much more viable candidate. Ted Cruz so far has shown a campaign going for far right wing support and evangelical support, so probably Mike Huckabee annoys Ted Cruz a lot more than John Kasich does.
Todd Zwillick seems to think that Jeb Bush is playing a long game, but he hasn't declared yet. There's your snapshot of the GOP candidates. Thanks so much, Todd.
You bet, John.
Matt Borges, chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, joins me now. He's advised many political campaigns in Ohio at the local, state, and national levels. Okay. Matt, welcome.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. So let's talk a little bit about where Ohio stands, and how excited are you about the possibility of a favorite son candidate if Governor John Kasich enters the race?
Well, we're awfully excited about that prospect, and just generally, Ohio being the epicenter of the political universe every 4 years, as it always is in a presidential cycle, maybe even more so this time than ever before. We have the Republican National Convention coming right to Cleveland next year. We're going to be starting the process of selecting our nominee. Or the Ohio Republican Party is hosting the first debate of the Republican hopefuls in August of this year. And so that process is underway. And so the fact that we also have an Ohioan very seriously considering getting involved in the race who... You know, we know as Republicans the path to the White House goes through Ohio. No Republican has ever gained the White House without carrying Ohio. And so to have a popular governor with a 61% approval rating here in the state potentially looking to lead our ticket, that certainly raises our prospects of doing well here, and not just that, but having a great appeal nationally as well.
Now, of course, if we have our wish and get rid of the Electoral College, then all this sort of all roads lead through Ohio goes away. But since we have it now, you are convinced that this strategy of having the convention in Cleveland and possibly Kasich being in the race and the changing demographics put Ohio plausibly in the GOP camp at this point, whoever the candidate is?
Well, we would certainly have to take advantage of those opportunities and make them work for us. We have seen in the past where conventions have been held in cities or in states where that particular candidate did not carry that state. Just in 2012, Barack Obama didn't carry North Carolina. Mitt Romney similarly didn't carry Florida. So it isn't necessarily an indicator of how are you going to do in the general election. But Ohio, as we know, as I said, the epicenter of the universe when we're doing these political campaigns every 4 years for president. But we haven't had an Ohioan in the mix since John Glenn tried to run in 1984, and it's really hard to put your finger on who was the last one before then. So to finally have an Ohioan focusing on this race and possibly running, I'm not sure. I'm hopeful that he gets in, but I don't know what his decision is going to be. I think that will raise the excitement level and enthusiasm level to a place where, for our party, we need to win here.
There's a real mystery in the demographics in Ohio. You've got, obviously, a Democratic Party leaning in the Cleveland area. That's clear. Towards the eastern part of the state, you have a lot of Democrats. But the central and western parts of the state are very, very traditionally conservative. How do you see that balance right now? And has it shifted appreciably in the last 4 years?
Well, we have seen a shift in eastern and southeastern Ohio to those traditionally blue counties turning redder over the years. And in our local elections, that's been very obvious. Certainly in 2014, we also have had the opportunity to win congressional districts in that part of the state for the first time in a long time and hold them. So our candidates are stronger, our messages are stronger. And one of the great things about bringing the convention to Cleveland, a part of the state where admittedly it's been a while since Democrats have really felt good and voters have really felt good about our party. Well, this is an opportunity for us to show the folks here locally a much different side of what we're all about. And, it's been since George Voinovich, who was former governor and United States Senator from Ohio, was the Republican mayor of Cleveland when I first got involved in Ohio politics, that we've really had a great Republican presence in this area. So we're going to try to take advantage of
state. Let me ask you a bit of a wild one here before we go, and we just have a few seconds. Bill Clinton was hugely popular in Ohio, and the Democratic Party did really well in terms of turning things around. The White House claims credit for changing the economy and having things on a growing sort of track right now. That doesn't seem like a formula for electing a Republican from the state of Ohio. How do you deal with that?
Well, let's not forget that the person who actually balanced that federal budget when President Clinton was in office was none other than Ohio's Governor John Kasich when he was chairman of the Budget Committee in Congress in those days. And one of the things that makes him an attractive potential candidate for the Republican field is that he's got more experience than any of these other candidates in terms of having done it at the federal level, certainly done it at the state level. That's reflected in a 61% approval rating now, and that certainly gives us a lot of hope.
Talking up John Kasich, the governor here in Ohio. Matt Borges is chairman of the Ohio Republican Party. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaert, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge. In select theaters now.
So we're broadcasting from the studios of WKSU at Kent State University in Ohio. Better believe this is our house. I'm holding this headline up to our studio audience. Huh? Does that excite you, folks? It's the headline in the Akron Beacon Journal on the 106-91 playoff victory for the Cleveland Cavaliers, the NBA playoff series against the Chicago Bulls, tied 1-1 here. Here in Kent, Ohio, near to LeBron James' actual house in Akron, which could also be called Jamestown, there is joy, but lots more to talk about today. Lots of Cavs fans in our live audience, as you heard. And we've got two of them right here in the studio. Laura Hunsker is from Akron, Ohio. You live not too far from LeBron?
Yes.
Yeah, do you get rides in the Escalade or his entourage?
He comes to my house all the
time.
He
comes to absolutely. Borrowing sugar. And the super fan Gary Knuth lives in Kent.
Right here.
All right. So are you concerned that the balls might have been deflated in the victory last night?
Not at all. Not at all.
Referencing the NFL scandal. None of that here. So are the Cavs going to go all the way? They've had a bit of a struggle maybe, Laura.
That happens. But he's a comeback guy.
Yeah,
he's from Akron, Ohio. Things are tough in northeastern Ohio, but we always come back.
And he certainly came back. How emotionally significant was that for you, Laura?
It wasn't emotionally significant for me. LeBron went away. He came back. And that's the way we are here.
That's it. So no problem. All is forgiven.
All is forgiven.
It was as though he never left. It was as though he never left.
Correct.
All right. Gary, how about you?
Well, it's great that LeBron's back. He certainly brought some leadership to the team. He said at the beginning of the season this was not going to be the year, yet he's proved that to be wrong. I think we're going all the way.
All right. What do you think emotionally it says about LeBron leaving the troubled city of Akron, out of high school, drafted to the NBA, going to Miami? There was all this, you know, anger. And then he did return. There's certainly a long-standing story of people leaving towns, little towns in Ohio, and making good and not coming back. Did he really reverse that trend on some level, Gary?
Well, we hope so. But, you know, our mayor said that LeBron he left Cleveland. He never left Akron. He never did. He supported Akron community, still supports the Akron community. But Cleveland is a forgiving town. And when they bring back a winner, they're going to forgive him for leaving.
So I sense from your voice, Gary, that Akron is a little farther from Cleveland even than Miami, maybe.
Very much so.
What does that mean politically? Are both of you voters? Yep. And do you think, do you agree with what the GOP chairman said, that Ohio could actually be a Republican state this time around, Laura?
I do not.
You don't believe it?
I think Ohio voters are independently minded individuals.
All right. So they won't go necessarily just because the convention is here and all of that.
Well, Kasich was governor when they voted for Obama. So
listen to her.
I think they will decide to do whatever they want to do in this upcoming election.
Gary, how about you?
I think it depends on who the candidate's going to be. Kasich has 61% approval rating, but in localities, people are feeling the effects of state tax cuts because it's come down to the municipalities. So I think when it comes time for election, people aren't going to forget that, nor will they forget that Governor Kasich tried to do away with collective bargaining for government employees, and I don't think that was very popular.
You know, the last big star, global star, John Glenn, tried to run for president and didn't make it. If LeBron James tries to do it, what do you think? Do you think he will, Gary?
I think he's smarter than that.
All right, Gary Knuth, a fan who lives in Kent, Ohio, Laura Hunsicker from Akron, Ohio. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. And if you're a regular listener to the pod, please know we value your thoughts as much as all the others. We'd love a review on iTunes, good or bad. We're in the business to attract more people just like you. So please share what you know. Poets find joy in all the little things of life, like a phone going off unexpectedly while you're waiting to pick up your kids.
Suddenly my phone is just rumbling uncontrollably. And I noticed that one of the messages had the word Pulitzer in it. And it was so utterly confusing and paralyzing.
What rhymes with Pulitzer? A problem you'd like to have, right? Well, poet Gregory Pardlow learned on April 20th that his latest collection of poems, a volume called Digest, that sold only 1,500 copies in its first printing, had won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. For this graduate student dad, it was a shocker that propelled him instantly to the front ranks of American poets. The Takeaway's Mithley Rao decided to go to Pardlow's Brooklyn streets and take a walk with the daydreaming boy from the hood who made good.
It was really quite a poetic scene. Pink cherry blossoms were drifting down onto the stoop of Gregory Pardlow's home in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn as we sat outside talking about the shock of his newfound fame.
every writer is familiar with the joke of when I win a Pulitzer, then all of this will change. You know, everything will fall into place. And so that's certainly a part of my family's narrative, although we never anticipated actually happening.
But then it did. And overnight, Pardlo became a local celebrity. The texts and emails kept pouring in on his phone, and people kept stopping him on the street to congratulate him. Even the local wine store got in on the excitement, advertising that it served the neighborhood of a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. While we were sitting on a stoop, Pardlo's neighbor Sidolian Calloway stopped by to tease him about his win.
I was just telling him. I'm glad to have been inspiration to him, you know, being his next-door neighbor and a friend. This is wonderful. We're going to share this, you know.
Pardlo told me Digest was the little book that could, a book that he revised for several years as it was repeatedly rejected by publishers. The poems in the book reflect deeply on daily life in Bed-Stuy.
Soon gangs will jump in, initiates, one toothy clamp at a time.
One poem describes trying to find someone help him jumpstart his car.
And civilians will jump all over each other with reciprocal gifts and hugs, finding power where power is given, a residual lifting of the spirits in the act.
Yet another is about hitting tennis balls in the handball court a few blocks away from his home.
The graying father of two swatted a juggle of balls against the playground wall that had been graffitied for an episode of Law and Order set in the hood. The desiccated cat gut of his racket strummed like a junkyard harp. What I'm interested in this book is pushing through my dream of this landscape and the irony of, or not the irony, but the contradiction between my dream life and the, you know, I have to sort the recycling. It has to go out. These things don't stop, no matter how deeply in our imaginative lives one might live. As I do, I still have to paint and fix the toilet.
My own favorite is Problema 3, a poem that takes place in Bed-Stuy's main grocery store.
The Fulton Street food town is playing Motown, and I'm surprised at how quickly my daughter picks up the tune. And soon, the two of us, plowing rows of goods steeped in fructose under light, thick as corn oil, are singing, "Baby, I Need Your Lovin'," unconscious of the lyrics foreboding. My happy child riding high in the shopping cart, as if she's cruising the polished aisles on a tractor laden with imperishable foodstuffs. Her cornball father enthusiastically prompting with spins and flourishes and the double barrel fingers of the gunslinger's pose. But we hear it as we round the rice and Goya aisle, that other music, the familiar exchange of anger, the war drums of parent and child.
The poem goes on to describe the father's attempts to distract his daughter from that scene of verbal abuse by promising to buy her ice cream. His ploy is not entirely successful.
So I noticed the woman getting rough with her son. And we started singing. I started singing with my daughter as a way of distracting her from what was going on. But, you know, kids, they pay attention to everything. So she was curious. And so I was trying to come up with different ways of distract her. By the end, she wanted to try to see what that feels like. Because clearly this mother loves her son, and you know, is that something that people can do in loving families? Well, yes. Frighteningly, yes, it is.
I asked him about another recent scene of a mother harshly disciplining her child, this one caught on video in Baltimore.
Get over here, Nick! Did you hear what I said?
Fox News dubbed Toya Graham Mom of the Year for grabbing and slapping her son after she saw him dressed in black, with a rock in his hand, ready to join the riots. But Pardlo said the video saddened him.
Of course, she's saying she's protecting him from the police, not from sort of misbehaving or damaging property or any of that stuff. She knows that he's in danger. You know, I know what this mother is doing. I get it, right? She's smacking the crap out of this kid because she's terrified that he's not going to understand, not going to recognize the limits So on one hand, you want to teach him those limits to protect him. On the other hand, it's heartbreaking they exist.
Those visible and invisible limits are the subject of the next pressing project on his list, his PhD dissertation, which is about the historical effects of slave-era practices that made it taboo for a black person to make eye contact with a white person.
How do we testify to what we see in the world and how what silences, certainly, you know, in a familial level and a societal level? What blindnesses do we teach our children, and how that becomes fact? You know, we end up literally not seeing things that are right in front of us.
Of course, the opposite is true in Pardlow's poetry. He starts by tackling what's immediately in front of him and then looks even farther.
For karma like that, you need a Winnebago covered with solar panels sprouting a fountain of jumper cables so you can spend your days suckling weary vehicles like an electric wet nurse. By your example, thugs would soon measure their cred by a tattooed lightning bolt under the eye to symbolize each battery they have sprung back to life.
Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gregory Pardlow with the Takeaways Monthly Row. To hear more of Pardlow's poetry and to see photos of his neighborhood in Brooklyn, head over to our website, thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway. And Moo, working to help bring business stories and brands to life through a range of printed products like business cards, flyers, stickers, and postcards. Also offering design templates and the option to upload a personal design. Learn more at Moo.com.
Adolf Hitler, the puny, shrieking dictator, was much pilloried and mocked on his way to power and World War II in Germany. There were political cartoons aplenty, and Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator film all produced laughs in their day. But after 1945, when the clear evidence of the Holocaust could not be disputed, to laugh about Hitler was to diminish his moral outrages, to suggest a tolerance for his butchery in some sense, or that his genocide of millions could be trivialized.
Germany was having trouble, what a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he?
Where could that man be?
And now it's
springtime for Hitler and Germany.
It was young director, comic writer, and Brooklyn Jewish draftee during World War II, Mel Brooks, who gave America the all-clear signal on laughing at Hitler with his controversial 1968 film, The Producers.
Look out, here comes the master race.
Brooks' film was followed by many other comedic treatments of Der Führer, but not in Germany. It has taken a much longer time for Germans to smile over all this in pop culture. A 2007 film, Mein Führer, The Truly Truest Truth About Adolf Hitler, was a commercial flop. But 8 years later, something may have changed. Look Who's Back, a novel by Timur Vermisch, has already sold 2 million copies in Germany. It imagines Hitler awakened like some creepy sleeping beauty and how he becomes, of all things, a famous TV talk show host. The book has been translated into 42 languages and comes out in the U.S. this week. Does author Vermisch think he has given Germany permission to laugh at the man responsible for its 20th century national horror?
If you read Mein Kampf, you find something totally crazy which you cannot connect to in any place, and which is very hard to imitate. But it was my surprise to find out that he had a certain not too complicated logic, which is possible to imitate. It was my own surprise that he was thinking in lots of ways, very practical, very logical, with his mistakes quite well hidden, I guess. Yeah, they're not too easy to find.
I think at the end of World War II, certainly many in the West, in the United States, who fought with the Allies, would have loved to have seen Hitler go through what Eichmann went through at Nuremberg, a sense of accountability. Do you think this book is in some way Hitler's humiliation and that people are entertained by it because he gets his nose rubbed in what happened after World War II on some level?
I don't think so, because would Hitler think that he gets his nose rubbed into something which he doesn't want to get his nose rubbed in.
Well, it certainly didn't turn out the way he wanted.
Yeah, but he noticed that at the end of the war already. But so whatever he did, he thought was the right thing, and he thought in the end of the war was the right thing. And if you would have a discussion with him today, most probably he would say, yeah, of course, it's still all right. So what do you want to rub my nose in? What else would he think?
He's like Nixon.
He's like every politician. What we like to imagine is there is someone like Hitler doing all the day evil stuff. He's rising in the morning and saying, well, today I'm going to do some real evil stuff. But he doesn't think that. He thinks he's doing the best for the population. And almost every politician is thinking like that. The closest, I guess, most politicians are coming to evil thinking is, I'm doing this only to be in power or to stay in power.
Hitler uses his famous charisma in this book and is able to mobilize his sense of charm to survive. Explain how you discovered that in the course of writing this.
I read about his life and I read how he acted himself.
Mm-hmm.
I read about different speeches. There was the table talk at the headquarters, which was quite important for me because it showed Hitler not in a political speech. He was talking on a table at a room volume, I'd say, and he was talking about everything, and he had an opinion to everything. And there you find some really crazy thoughts and some other thoughts which are quite normal, like in front of a kindergarten, drive carefully. In moments like that, you notice that this should be or must be the way it worked. He could connect to people in sort of normal thinking. And people back then were not thinking they were electing a lunatic. So he must have seemed quite normal for most people.
I love that idea.
Yeah, but...
In a trivia contest, you go, who said drive carefully in front of a kindergarten? Tick, 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 tick. Adolf Hitler. You know, it's hysterical.
But that shows how the book works.
Yeah.
Because we are expecting a monster doing totally crazy things. And what he is delivering is sometimes normal, sometimes polite, and this is already enough to make him look like a nice guy. Some people after the book ask me, how could you portray him such a nice guy? And I say, okay, now where exactly is he a nice guy? He is doing whatever he's doing for a purpose, to get back to power, and whatever he can use, he will do.
Are there situations that you wanted to try in this book that you weren't able to pull off?
There were two situations. One situation was I found a chapter in Mein Kampf, which I found perfectly funny. It was Hitler is telling us how to read correctly because he's the only person in the world able to read correctly. And I thought, this is hilarious. I can use this almost directly. But it didn't work. It was unsatirizable, maybe.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah.
So we had to leave that away. The other part was I wanted to confront him as close as possible with the Holocaust. But who could have a discussion with him? The advantage the reader has, and only the reader has, is the reader knows this is the real Hitler. And no person in the book, no character of the book, can know the same because time traveling is simply not possible. People must think he is an actor because he is 56 years old. The real Hitler would be dead or 120. So there is no way any character can think this is the real one.
You have quite an imagination, Timur.
Yeah.
Can you imagine Steven Spielberg being a guest on Hitler's show?
He maybe wouldn't be the first guest. But... Okay.
Yeah, that's good. You think like a producer.
Yeah, the show is running, and the show is running for a year, and it has hilarious writing. And this Hitler guy is witty, and he is able to react very fast. We are all totally convinced that he's no Nazi, and it's a very interesting experience to be in his show. And were you invited to the Hitler show? Absolutely hilarious, and he's so evil, he's so witty and biting, but he's clever. And then after a year, and after maybe Charlie Sheen has been there, then of course Steven Spielberg would say, it has something to it. I go there and he delivers sorts of discussion you never have had in TV until now because he's so serious and could be working.
Timur Vermish is the author of Look Who's Back. It's a satire about Adolf Hitler out in the United States this week. That's all for today. Our thanks to WKSU for hosting us here in Ohio. We'll be in Kent in the Akron area all this week. You can find me on Twitter at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaert, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge. In select theaters now.
PRI, Public Radio International.